Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three. My name is Mark Rader. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we look at three questions that were raised from Sunday's sermon. We are continuing in our series, The Fruit of the Spirit, looking at a life changed by Jesus and using as kind of our base passage, kind of like a base camp of sorts, the passage of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. And on Sunday, Adam Stewart, one of our associate pastors, was preaching on the first fruit in the list. We have talked about fruitfulness in general and the role of the Holy Spirit and the list of the anti-fruit that Paul includes, the vice lists. And so if we finally kind of gotten into the fruit of the Spirit in Adam, led us on some reflections around the fruit of love, which is the first fruit that Paul lists for us. We're going to look at love on its own, joy on its own, then we're going to lump a bunch together in order that we can get the series done before Christmas is basically how that works. But at any rate, we looked at love on the weekend. And Adam focused our attention a little bit on the parable of the Good Samaritan as an expression, a demonstration of this self-sacrificial love that we are called to. I spoke about the alignment of our love with the work and purposes of God. And we're going to pick some of that stuff up in the questions that were asked. So there are three questions today. That's the big three. Is it noteworthy that love is the first on the list? I guess Paul could put them in any order. They don't appear to be in any particular order, but it is striking, I suppose, that love is first. So is that noteworthy? And if so, why? Secondly, why does Paul only mention love for others and not love for God in Galatians 5:14, like Jesus does in the parable? So in Galatians, in the section just before, the verses just before Paul lists the fruit of the Spirit, he does say that the whole law is fulfilled if you love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus, famously, when asked about the most important law, basically said that the law hangs on two: love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. Those get picked up in the introduction to the parable of the Good Samaritan. So why is it that Paul only mentions the one? And then third, God's love in sending Jesus is easy to recognize. In the Old Testament, it's much harder. How is God's love expressed before Jesus? And this, I think, taps into the, the perception that the God of the Old Testament is kind of more cranky and grumpy and wrathful than loving and gracious and gentle. You know, you have, and there's all sorts of reasons for that perception, but it is a worthwhile one thinking through in terms of the way in which God's love is expressed in the Old Testament and the New, given that we believe that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So we'll dive into these questions and continue to think a little bit about the virtue of love and about its role in the fruit of the Spirit in the purposes and plans of God. So is it noteworthy that love is the first fruit that Paul lists? And the short answer is yes, I think that it is. It's difficult, as you know, Adam touched on a few places in the New Testament in particular where love is highlighted, right? So even the definition they looked at in 1 John 4, God is love. You know, and if God is love, then putting love at the first, as first in a list of virtues is probably not a bad idea. But the virtue of love is routinely given a place of prominence, right? So, you know, Paul in, say, 1 Corinthians 13, you know, the ode to love. I mean, Paul talks about that as the most excellent way, describing love as being better than just about anything else that you can do. And if you do a bunch of things like, you know, prophesy or speak in tongues or give all that you have to the poor, but you don't actually have love, then it's really kind of a waste of time. And so love is the dominant virtue, right? It's one of three, what they often refer, they scholars refer to as the theological virtues: faith, hope, and faith, joy, and I should have looked this up beforehand. The greatest of these is love, faith, hope, and love. Faith, hope, and love. Here I am thinking out loud rather than having looked at that beforehand. Nonetheless, it's one of those significant key theological virtues from which the other virtues arise or flow from, right? To some degree, they function a little bit like the seven deadly sins, if you've ever heard of them, you know, pride and wrathfulness and laziness and whatnot. And those were called deadly sins, but also like capital sins. They're the ones from which all other sins flow, so to speak. And the theological virtues and love at their head is kind of the very basis of all of the other virtues. So you could suggest that, you know, all the fruit of the Spirit, whether you're talking about patience or kindness or gentleness, self-control, it can all be related back to love. So I think it is quite significant that Paul lists it first, in part because he often lists it first, and other New Testament authors give love a high priority. But it's also, and I don't want to kind of drift into the next question too early, but it's also, I think, linked to the circumstance and situation that Paul was addressing. I think that's actually a really important piece of context for understanding the list in Galatians 5. The epistles as a whole, these New Testament letters, were always written to a particular group of people who were experiencing a particular thing. There's a the scholars describe them as occasional documents. There's an occasion that calls the document forth, right? And that occasion is actually really important to understanding what is being written down. So if you think about, we don't really think documents anymore, but if you were to think about, say, like a eulogy, a speech at a 21st, the occasion would shape the nature of the speech, right? In the one case, a funeral. And so it would sound different. It would be a little bit more formal, right? Like there'd be more of an honoring. At 21st, you might hear more jokes, you might hear more anecdotes, but then there'd be some really heartfelt pieces, right? And so the occasion is important. In Galatians, Paul is addressing a couple of pastoral issues, one of which has to do with their belief and some false teaching. It's false teachers who had come through and kind of convinced them that they needed to really become Jews first and then become Christians, which sort of makes, I guess, some sort of logical sense, but not a theological sense, as Paul argues. You know, the whole idea that Jesus was Jewish and the fulfillment of Jewish scriptures, and therefore to become Jewish seems to be like the first step to becoming a Christian. And Paul is seeking to correct that teaching. But there also appears to have been some significant community concerns. And so Paul, I think, even if love elsewhere were not the most important virtue, which it is, I think Paul possibly would have elevated it to the top of the list because of the situation that he was addressing. So short answer, although I've managed to make it long, is that yes, I think it is noteworthy that love is first on the list. Paul makes no editorial comment about it. He doesn't say, you know, the greatest virtue is love and then all the rest. He doesn't say that the most important fruit is love. He makes no comment on it. But the fact that it's listed first, I think, should not surprise us given the way it's spoken about elsewhere in the New Testament. So I've talked a little bit about occasion of the epistle and the pastoral issues that Paul was addressing, which I think probably also shaped the second question, which is why does Paul only mention love for others and not love for God in Galatians 5:14, like Jesus does in the parable. So Paul elevates the second part of that, of those commands, to, shall we say, to be the only command, which is curious. So the debate, apparently, and I'm not super familiar with this, but there was debate within Judaism around the most important of the laws. Not suggesting that some were not important. They were all important, but I think the language was actually about something like the heavy laws and the light laws. They were all important, but some were really heavy. So you think about, I remember reading something somewhere that, you know, like one of the lightest laws was if you find a bird's nest, you can take the eggs, but don't take the mother or something like that. Like it's that kind of a law. And they said it's an important law because God's given it, but it's a light law as opposed to, you know, do not murder. Like if you compared those two, I think we would say, you know, both, I guess, are sins, right? If they transgress the law, but murder is a little bit more significant than what you do when you find a bird's nest. So there was a fair amount of discussion around how you could summarize the law or the most significant laws and whatnot. And so when Jesus is asked, you know, what's the most important law, he was being invited into a bit of a rabbinical debate, right? The debates of the rabbis. And his response, which we can imagine, it was not necessarily radical, but it became a pretty important part of his teaching that his disciples picked up on, is that he summarized the law in two. In Deuteronomy, you'll love the Lord your God with all your, Deuteronomy 6, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, right? That's the first law. And then the second is from Leviticus 19, where it's love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said, those are the two that summarize the law. So when the expert in the law in Luke chapter 10, just before Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, when he comes to Jesus and asks him, you know, what must I do? And Jesus says, you know, how do you read the law? The guy responds with, like, shall I say, the right answer. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus basically says, yeah, that's it. Do that and you'll live. And then he asks the follow-up question, who's my neighbor? And Jesus tells the parable. And the parable of the Good Samaritan then is meant to be a bit of an expansion on the love that we're to express to our neighbor. And as Adam picked up, you know, that's self-sacrificial, that's some risk to it. You know, there's all sorts of elements to that parable, right? The Samaritan would have been considered, if not an enemy, at least with suspicion by Jews. He would have had no real place in Jewish society, and yet he just kind of goes. In fact, when I was you know, rereading the text as Adam was speaking, it did occur to me, I think, you know, when Adam was doing the piece around all the things that the Samaritan would have had to have done and the decisions that he had to make, it occurred to me that the way the story is told, it suggests that this Jewish fellow was unconscious the whole time. Like he says nothing, he does nothing, he gets beaten up, and then he's just cared for. But I don't know that that's necessary for the story. Like he could have been awake, like he could have been lucid, he could have just been in a lot of pain, and how he would have handled that was quite striking, which is totally a tangent. But so I think that when you consider these two laws, right? If I can come back to the point that Jesus kind of held up as the summary of the law, Paul is obviously in Galatians 5 picking up some of the language of Jesus's teaching, right? I think we find it in the use of the fruit imagery, which Jesus uses. We find it in the emphasis on love, which Jesus speaks about, right? Those sorts of things. The fact that Paul, I don't want to say ignores, because that sounds like he is deliberately choosing not to engage with something, but he doesn't talk about love of the Lord your God. He just talks about love your neighbor. And I think that indicates two things. I think first of all, it points to what I said in answer to the first question, that there was a tension within the community of faith that had led to not love. You know, as Paul says, if you keep biting and devouring each other, right, you're going to be undone. So it sounds like it had gotten pretty bad. And in the early church, in particular, one of the conflict lines was between Jews and Gentiles, like Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. They just came from completely different worldviews about, you know, things that you could eat and things that you could do. And now they were all mingling together and probably offending each other left, right, and center, kind of by accident, you know, just doing stuff that was very proper for a Gentile, but was just totally offensive to Jews. And Jews were doing and saying things that were totally offensive to Gentiles. And it just kind of, you know, on and on it goes. And so Paul, I think, is wanting to focus on that, first of all. But I also believe that the two laws, the loving the Lord your God and the loving your neighbor as yourself, I suppose you can see loving your neighbor theologically as summarizing the whole law, just as you could probably say loving God is the summary of the whole law too. I think it's easier to start from loving God rather than starting from loving from neighbor. But and here's how I think it works. If we love God and we want God's ways to succeed, then we want to get on board with doing what he's doing, which means that we have to love neighbor. Like our love of God includes love of neighbor. As John the Apostle says in his epistles, and I believe this is one of the passages that Adam picked up on in 1 John 3, you know, we don't love just with words with deeds, right? In that section, Adam didn't refer to it, but I think it's the verse before the verse after. He basically says, if you see someone in need and you don't do anything about it, you don't really have love, right? So if we say we love God, but we don't care for our neighbor, if we say that we are all about God's ways in the world, but we don't actually do God's work in the world, then we're missing something, right? So the love of God implies love of neighbor. And to some degree, in the context in which Paul is writing, to say, love your neighbor, when he's talking, you know, he's not talking about general ethics. He's talking about a Christian community, right? He's continually talking about, well, the fruit of the Spirit. He's talking about the example of Jesus. He's talking about the plans and purposes of God. So it's well within the construct of a Christian belief. And he says, love your neighbor. That's the summary of the law. The whole law is caught up in that. And to some degree, I think what he's saying is, if you love your neighbor in the power of the Spirit, and you love your neighbor in the power of the Spirit to fulfill the work of Christ in the world, which was done for the will of the Father, by the will of the Father, then you are demonstrating your love for God, is how I would argue it. Right? That it's that the love of neighbor in a Christian context, right, because I think the Christian context is important, implies then a love for the God who sends us to love our neighbor. So I think Paul elevates it because of the crisis in the community, but I also believe that you can summarize them. But the Christian context is critical. One of the things that we've danced around a little bit on a few occasions in this series already is around the difference between the fruit of the Spirit and the fruit of just a good life. Right? And I think this is where the Christian context and the purposes of God become so important. Christians are, and I've said this before, I'm not sure if I've said it on the big three before, but Christians are not, strictly speaking, philanthropists, right? Philanthropy comes from the Greek term philos, which is brotherly love, from which we get, well, philanthropy and Philadelphia and those sorts of things. It is love for our fellow human being, right? It's that brotherly, sisterly, familial love that we express to those around us. Strictly speaking, Christians are never philanthropists because the love that we express to our neighbor is not just love to our neighbor. Love to our neighbor as followers of Jesus is always an expression of our love for God. We are first and foremost those who love God. And because we love God and because God loves humanity, we love humanity. So obviously we can be engaged in works of philanthropy, but from a theological perspective, our focus is always on our love for God. And I think that's what Paul is getting at here in Galatians 5:14. So the last question is potentially very, very big. I'll see how we go. God's love in sending Jesus is easy to recognize. In the Old Testament, it's much harder. How is God's love expressed before Jesus? So one of the common misperceptions I think that Christians can have and have had between the New Testament and the Old Testament is, shall we say, the differences in tone and the differences, I was going to say in style, which might be close, but the Old and New Testaments are quite different, right? And you know, by the time you get to Jesus, who says things like, you know, turn the other cheek and love your neighbor as yourself, it puts some of the things in the Old Testament kind of in contrast. And in the Old Testament, we often have God, responding with discipline to his people, with wrathfulness, that there seems to be a lot more of that kind of edge. And so how do we hold these together, right? Like how, if I said to you, listen, you don't get the New Testament, you can only use the Old. I want you to demonstrate to me the love of God. There would be a handful of questions, of course, a handful of passages that you could turn to that demonstrate God's love quite clearly, right? There are a couple of places in the law where Moses says to the people, God didn't choose you because you were amazing or you were the biggest or best nation. He chose you because he loved you, right? There are places in, say, the book of Malachi where God says to the people through the prophet, you know, the Lord says, I've loved you. And you say, how have you loved us? There are passages in Hosea, which demonstrate God's deep affection and compassion for his people, the way in which he loves them so fiercely and jealously. And so I think that there are a few of those sorts of places where you could look to see God's love. But I think, you know, if God's love is demonstrated in the sending of Jesus, then you could say that God's love is also demonstrated in the things that he does in the Old Testament. While, you know, we looked at Genesis, when God creates the world, he doesn't create the world because he loves the world, at least that in terms of explicitly stated, right? Like that's not stated for us. But we do get the sense of God's commitment to his creation and to humanity within it, and his grace that keeps being expressed to them, which again is not necessarily love, but is love adjacent, right? Like there's a sense that God's concern is for his created order, not just himself in the midst of that. And the things that God does then need to be understood against the backdrop of God's plans and purposes in the world, right? The plans and purposes, which are not just for his things to be done, but in order that people and the whole created order might experience the blessing of living with God. Like that's the big picture, right? That God desired from the very beginning that we live in harmony with him and with one another and with the created order and experience the blessing of doing so. And so all that God does in the selection of Abraham and in the establishment of the people of Israel and in the giving of King David to the people and in the sending of the prophets and the delay in his punishment, the discipline of, you know, the prior acts of discipline, which were never meant, were always meant to pull people back, right? In Hosea, he puts it really powerfully. Like he basically says, listen, I sent famines, but you never kind of did the math and went, wait a minute, this is from God, meant to draw us back. They never responded to the disasters as being sent from God as his discipline to turn them back to him. So there's this sense that all the way through the Old Testament, God's actions are for his plans and purposes in the world and in humanity. And again, while that's not often described as love, we see the continued commitment to his plans and purposes and to his people. His acts of discipline are seen as acts of love. They're the actions of a father or a mother, right? Who, in our best moments, are bringing discipline to our children's lives because we love them, because we don't want them to turn into complete rat bags, because we do want them to understand boundaries and, right, good behavior and all those sorts of things. Well, that's what God does as well. There are some instances where God is referred to as a father. Not very many in the Old Testament, but there are a handful where that picks that language up. In Hosea, as I mentioned, God is portrayed quite radically as a wounded lover, as a husband to his people, which again, while not describing, you know, kind of romantic love, certainly has some of those elements to it. So I think it's a little bit more difficult to point to a passage, you know, like you have in 1 John, where it's God is love. You're like, oh, well, there it is. Or this is how we know what love is, that, you know, God sent Jesus, where it's really clear and we're like, gotcha. You know, for God so loved the world that he sent his one and only son. Like, there are some really clear passages of that. In the Old Testament, there are not as many of those clear references, but I think we see the commitment of God to his people as an expression of his love for the creation, and for humanity within it. And as I said, there are a handful of places where it does talk about God's love for his people. There are a number of places where I think we simply see God's commitment to his people expressed in his actions. And that, I think, is really quite important and significant to note. Bottom line is, we do need to see the connections between the Old and New Testament. The Old Testament, you've heard me talk about this before, I think. What we have in the Bible is progressive revelation, right? Like, if you read the story from beginning to end, like just like any story, characters at the beginning don't know how the story ends. We do, but the characters within it do not. And that matters for, you know, how we interpret particular passages. But it also means that there are certain things, certain themes, certain ideas that develop and change. You know, so think about the issue of, I guess what I might call broadly violence, right? Where Jesus comes across as pretty much a pacifist. And in the Old Testament, the people of Israel are sent into battle and those sorts of things. And I don't think that that's necessarily a reflective of a change in God as it is the change of circumstances. The people of Israel were a geopolitical nation. Like, they had land and boundaries. They had foreign policy and taxation and, right, all the systems of justice and government that you need to run a geopolitical reality. And that brought with it, in part because there were other geopolitical realities, that brought with it war. It brought with it, you know, the way in which a government rules over its own people and seeks to expand and negotiate territory and all those sorts of things. Like, it's kind of part of the reality. When Jesus comes announcing the new kingdom, he's not talking about a geopolitical reality. He's not. Trying to set up a geopolitical reality. The kingdom of God that he announces is very, very different. And those differences mean that there can be more space for, right, this kind of pacifist, nonviolent approach, right, the turning the other cheek and those sorts of things. So we have to pay attention to the differences that we find and then look for the consistency of God's character. The ways in which God addresses these things, and the way in which God enables and empowers his people, the way he encourages them to trust in him and all of those sorts of things, and draw those parallels. And the example of violence is, to be fair, a really big one, but I think we can see the consistency throughout. Even in the New Testament, there are examples of... You know, speaking of God's judgment or of the battle at the end in which Jesus leads the armies into battle and whatnot. So there is a sense that those Old Testament images get picked up and carried on into the new as well. So in answer to the question, I think God's love is expressed before Jesus in all sorts of different ways. Primarily, just like in the new, through the demonstration of his love in the covenants, even in the giving of the law, which was meant to be a blessing to the people of Israel, right? To lead them into a way to experience the best life. In his sending of the prophets to warn them of the discipline that he engaged in order to draw them back to himself, the patience that he expresses, his commitment to them even after the exile and bringing them back from the exile, the promises that he made about the Messiah to come. I think there are lots and lots of ways in which God's love is expressed in the Old Testament. Obviously, all of them, to some degree, point to Jesus as the ultimate example of God's love for us. Which is, of course, part of the reason why it's front and center for us as followers of Jesus. So trust that's been helpful as we continue to think through the fruit of the Spirit. This coming week, we're going to be looking at the singular fruit of joy. As I said before, we're going to start moving a little bit more quickly through the fruits of the Spirit. Again, focusing on what that has to say to us and the way in which it might shape our life as followers of Jesus. But until then, hope you can join us on Sunday and join me again next week for the Big Three. And until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are the Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.